This is Maggie Jones and Natural Wonders. I'll be reading again from Sumner Madison's book, A Field. I've read many times from this book. I've read the chapters about Sigurd Olsen and Jim Zimmerman and Eric Epstein and Increase Lapham, among others. I've read the entire foreword written by Kurt Meine. I'll read a little bit of the foreword today. For 40 years, Sumner has regularly made time to record the stories of Wisconsin field biologists, ecologists, conservation biologists, and land stewards. Among them are the well-known and recognized, as well as the more obscure and overlooked. All made vital contributions to natural history and conservation in Wisconsin. Some were scientists and teachers. Others were writers and advocates, public servants and citizens. All in some way were wisdom keepers. Their lives span a century and a half, and many never met. Yet they are connected across their diverse places and times and experiences. They shared a passion for what Aldo Leopold called things natural, wild, and free. They carried the same conviction that we are bonded to the land and all its inhabitants, and to one another upon it. Sumner's perseverance in gathering their voices has only increased the value of his work. In fact, we need these voices and stories now more than ever. We need them to ground us as we face a future of rapidly changing social, economic, and environmental realities, most especially the uncertain effects of accelerating climate change. We need them more than anything to nurture the next generation of citizen conservationists. Those are words from Kurt Meine's foreword to A Field. We owe Sumner Madison so much for putting this together over decades of work, pursuing all these people and interviewing them or researching their lives if they're gone. Today I'll be reading Chapter 15. Joseph Martin Rose. And Sumner writes, "In the year 2000, I asked biologist Joe D. Rose of the Bad River Band of the Lake Superior Chippewa Indians who he might recommend from the tribe for inclusion in the Wisconsin Naturalist Project. I had met Joe through the Wisconsin Trumpeter Swan Recovery Program in the mid-1990s. He didn't hesitate. 'Why don't you interview my father?' he said. When I called Joseph Martin Rose, Joe Rose Sr., an Ojibwe elder and associate professor of Native American Studies at Northland College, he didn't hesitate either. 'Sure,' he said, 'come on up.' A review of not-too-distant Native American history reminds us that the Ojibwe people of the Upper Midwest witnessed the loss of their lands to the U.S. federal government in the 19th century. Treaties in 1836, 1837, 1842, and 1854 led to the establishment of ceded territories and a reservation system that continues today. At Odena, near Ashland, the Bad River Band occupies a reservation that includes one of the Upper Midwest's largest and arguably least disturbed coastal wetland complexes, part of the Kagagan River and Bad River watershed. 16,000 acres, or 25 square miles, are recognized as a Ramsar wetland of international importance. Joseph Rose, born April 1935 to Carl and Mary Dolly Rose, grew up on the Bad River Reservation during the early 1940s. Here, he learned mainly through his grandfather how to trap, fish, and hunt, and to become acquainted with the animals and plants that inhabited the area. Joe attended local schools in the Ashland area, graduating from DePadua High School in 1953 and from Northland College in 1958 with a Bachelor of Science degree in biology and secondary education. For 10 years after graduating from Northland College, he worked as a high school science and math teacher and athletic coach. During 1970 through 74, he was deployed as a counselor for Bad River students at Ashland High School. In 1971, he received a Master of Science degree in education from Black Hills State University in Spearfish, South Dakota. He began teaching Native American Studies at Northland College in Ashland in 1974. He retired in 2012. Our interview took place at his office at Northland College during a bright morning on October 6, 2001. Later that afternoon, I joined his students for a field trip to the shore of Lake Superior, where Professor Rose has a cabin and sweat lodge, and where he taught his students about the sacred aspects of a sweat lodge ceremony. And now, Elder and Professor Joe Rose, Sr. My culture is Anishinaabe. I can go back at least five generations. In 1852, President Millard Fillmore rescinded the order of President Zachary Taylor to remove Native Americans from their lands, and that led to the Treaty of 1854, which established reservations for all of the Lake Superior Ojibwe in Minnesota, Wisconsin, and Michigan. My grandfather, Dan Jackson Sr., had two grandfathers that signed the Treaty of 1854. One was Chief Condicon from Ontonagon, and the other was Chief Blackbird from Bad River. In fact, the administration building at Bad River is named after him, the Chief Blackbird Center. Blackbird was quite an orator. He often stood up and spoke at the councils. There were certain issues, such as distribution of monies and goods, that they discussed. These fur traders that had extended credit to Indian people were always there with their hands out whenever the Indians received their annuities or any payments for the land that they had given up. They wanted the government administrators to pay them before paying the Indians. Blackbird, on one occasion, arose and insisted that money goes to the people first and then to the fur traders. The treaties of 1837, 1842, and 1854 were all land cession treaties where millions of acres were given up, but the right to hunt, fish, and gather was retained in the negotiations between the Indian leaders and the commissioners of the United States government. The ceded territory is pretty large, pretty big, about the northern one-third of the state of Wisconsin, about the northeastern one-quarter of the state of Minnesota, and most of the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. These treaty rights, however, were violated by the government for several generations, but finally reaffirmed by a decision of a federal court in 1983. This was known as the Voight decision. Indian people did not have the financial resources to fight for their rights for many years. Also, Native people were not educated formally in the white man's way. I remember over 30 years ago when the Great Lakes Intertribal Council had a subcommittee called the Great Lakes Intertribal Council Education Committee, which represented all the Indians in the state of Wisconsin in matters of education. I remember in 1971 or 72, we did a survey to find out how many Indians had earned a college degree. At that time, you could count them on the fingers of both hands. I was fortunate enough to be one of them. History offers the wisdom of perspective. A little-known fact is that the United States Constitution is based on many of the principles of the Iroquois and Algonquin confederacies that operated on the eastern seaboard prior to European presence. By the time George Washington and Thomas Jefferson came along, there had been 150 years of relations with the tribes. Washington and Jefferson came from a monarchy, and when their forefathers came over, they had never encountered the idea that leaders were servants of the people. Leaders were representatives of the people. These leaders could be recalled if they didn't support the wishes of the people. So some of these ideas were incorporated into the Constitution of the United States. Benjamin Franklin, for one, was quite knowledgeable about the way these Indian confederacies operated. Indians aren't given credit for that because they were considered pagans, savages, and heathens in 1789 when the Constitution was ratified. The irony is that Native American people are some of the most patriotic in this country. In the two world wars we've fought, to the best of my knowledge, there have been a higher percentage of Native Americans per capita who have fought in the armed forces of the United States than any other ethnic group. This is their homeland. They didn't immigrate here from somewhere else. That bond with the land is very strong. My mother left the reservation to attend Haskell Indian School in Kansas. Upon graduation, she was sent to work as a medical stenographer at a veterans hospital in Muskogee, Oklahoma. Muskogee is where she met my father, who in high school had played on the Oklahoma State Championship football team and made the Oklahoma All-State team at the left end position. He was offered a full scholarship to play football for Louisiana State University, LSU. He passed up a chance to play Division I football and instead married my mother. I was born in Muskogee, Oklahoma, and shortly afterward, my mother and dad moved to Odena, Wisconsin, because of the strong cultural and family ties that my mother had. I'm a mixed-blood Ojibwe. My mother's Ojibwe, and my dad is white. I experienced discrimination when I was growing up, mostly from white society. In fact, I think it's even worse for mixed bloods because the dominant society knows that if you have a choice, you can go either way, and you're not choosing their way. There were a few Indians when I was going to grade school that saw me as white rather than Indian. I knew there was a pecking order, so I fought my way to the top of it and was then accepted as Indian. I was a good street fighter. We had relatives all over the reservation. The clan system was still pretty strong. I remember the sense of community that was so much stronger when I was a boy. Families used to visit each other. In fact, I grew up in my grandfather's old house. We had visitors almost on a daily basis there, and there weren't any locked doors. Sometimes people would rap on the door before they'd come in. Other times they'd just walk in and sit down. We didn't have indoor plumbing. We used to haul our water from the town pumps. We didn't have central heating. We heated with wood. We'd sit around the old wood stove in my grandfather's living room. The old people would come in. Their first language was Ojibwe, but they spoke broken English. We'd listen to many stories about Native American traditions. My grandmother also had the old wood kitchen range. She'd put out a bowl of soup or something, or maybe go into the bedroom and dig out a jar of canned blackberries and serve them with homemade bread. They'd sit there and visit. You knew every person in the community from the little kids on up. That's not true anymore. I don't know why it has changed. People just don't get together like that anymore, perhaps because of all the new technology, from automobiles to television to computers. Grandfather's mother was from Bad River, and his father was from Ontonagon, Michigan, along the Upper Peninsula, Lake Superior shore. Those families moved back and forth between the two reservations pretty often. He said they used to travel back and forth between Ontonagon and Bad River in birch bark canoes. When a storm would come up, they would just beach the canoes and camp out there. We didn't have electricity in our homes when I grew up on the reservation. My mother used to read by kerosene lamp to my brother and me every night before we went to bed. I remember studying by kerosene lamp. Growing up, there were probably about a dozen cars on the Bad River Reservation. People walked everywhere they went. Kids spent most of their waking hours out of doors, and you had your chores every night when you got home from school. After chores, we might go out and look at our rabbit snares after dark. I always had a little pack with a flashlight in it. We'd go out back in the woods and check the rabbit snares with the flashlight. There wasn't any television. A few people had battery-operated radios. Kids would get together at somebody's house with a radio and listen to the Green Bay Packers football game on Sunday. The rest of the time, we were outside. We were in excellent physical shape. Nowadays, the kids sit indoors. You get some of these kids out in the woods and they can't tell the difference between a popple tree and a birch tree. It's an altogether different lifestyle than we had. We have to teach our young people about the sacredness of the land. We have to get them out there and let them experience the natural world and pull them away from these boom boxes, Nintendo, TV, soda pop, potato chips, and even in some cases alcohol and hard drugs. Give them a chance to experience the natural world. If they begin to experience the natural world, they'll begin to understand it. From an understanding comes respect. From that respect comes love. And when they begin to love that natural world, when they begin to feel that in their own spirit, then they'll stand and defend the natural world. They'll challenge those who would upset the balance, pollute, degrade the earth, the water, and the air. Challenge those that are responsible for all of those species that are becoming endangered or extinct. And that's where I'll stop reading chapter 15 about Joseph Martin Rose, elder and professor, from Sumner Madison's book, A Field. I will continue next week with the last part of this chapter. This is Maggie Jones and Natural Wonders. Thank you for listening.